My Mac Podcast 154. It's a slew of Apple updates, and this week, playing the part of Chad Perry, David Cullen.
The next generation of radio. It's the MyMac.com podcast.
And boy, was there a lot of Apple updates this week. And one of the cool updates is Apple selling the phone in the UK. The iPhone is for sale in the UK. And David Cullen, all the way from the UK. Hi, David.
Hi. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Where are you in England?
I live in Manchester, which is about 250 miles north of London.
So
right in the middle of the country.
So the iPhone was released. You, I take it, went to the Apple store?
I didn't go to the Apple store. I drive past a couple of Carphone Warehouse and O2 stores on my way home from work. Interestingly enough, there's been a bit of stuff on the web since it was launched saying that the stores on Friday night weren't as busy as people were expecting. I'm not surprised at that, really, because, you know, culturally, we don't really do shopping after work, particularly on a Friday. So I'm not surprised it wasn't as busy, perhaps, as some people would have thought. I hear the Apple store in Manchester was quite busy on the Friday night, but certainly the stores I drove past were, there was quite a lot of salespeople and not many customers. Though on the Saturday morning, I went past another store and there were more people in. So, the word is apparently O2 and Apple are quite happy with the first weekend sales. I was in London on Tuesday and I saw maybe 3-4 people using iPhones on the tube network as I was travelling around, which is not something I'd seen before. So anecdotally, it does seem to be that people are using them and enjoying them.
Also on the show this week is Guy Searle. Hi, Guy.
Hello, hello.
I understand that there in Virginia, the iPhone is already for sale, correct?
yeah, for a while now. It's weird. Other than I think one person, I have yet to see one in the wild.
Really?
Yeah. Well, this is DC, so unless it's the popular model that everyone has, you're not going to see it.
David, I understand that most mobile phones aren't tied to one carrier in the UK, correct?
Well, yes, they are, in fact. I mean, you often when you get a mobile phone, it will be locked. It's relatively rare to find a phone, if you buy it with a contract, for it to be unlocked initially. Though after 12 months, it's normally quite easy to get out of the contract and unlock it without paying stiff penalties, which I believe you often have to do in the US. There's plenty of backstreet places which will unlock any phone after it's been out for a month or two. So it'd be interesting to see whether those guys start covering the iPhone in the next couple of months.
Do you think the iPhone's going to have much of a cultural impact there?
I think so. I think as a country, we're very big on consumer spending. We like gadgets, and Apple is pretty big over here now. You can always tell when something's become popular because all of our media start to knock it slightly, and certainly that's where Apple is at the moment. Is that that most of the stories have a slightly negative spin on them, and that's when that somebody's really actually being successful because we start trying to knock them over.
You know why gadgets are very popular in England?
Why is that?
James Bond.
Of course.
It's all Bond's fault.
That's right.
I think, up until the James Bond movies, it didn't seem like gadgets were that big of a deal in any country. And then after James Bond, everything was gadgets, miniature this and miniature that. And I blame James Bond for the iPhone. I think it's his fault.
I watched one of our local BBC spy thrillers yesterday, and they used a Bluetooth mobile phone to set off charges through a plane to bring it down.
Well, it's realistic anyways. Did either of you catch the 24 from
1994.
Four, yeah. Did you catch that?
That was pretty
funny. No, I heard about it. Was that with, what's his name?
No, Kiefer Sutherland? No.
Yeah.
No, it's a spoof.
Oh, okay. It's right over my head.
Yeah, the whole thing is about they're using 1994?
94,
yeah. Yeah, 1994 technology in the show. So, like, he gets a page and he has to run down to a cell phone, and they're logging on to America Online and we've got mail. Send him the file. I can't. It's more than 24K. And it's hilarious. I was cracking up. I didn't think I was going to enjoy it much, but I found myself just cracking up. And I think it helps if you were actually using that technology at the time.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's amazing, actually, when you watch 24, he has the best cell phone coverage and the highest bandwidth and the most powerful PDAs I've ever seen.
It gets a little ridiculous sometimes. One year, all the good guys are using Dells, and then the next year, they're all using Macs, and then...
A lot of my clients, actually, they like the Cisco IP phones because they're the same as they use in the counter-terrorist unit on 24.
You know, the funny thing is, Kiefer Sutherland is not anything like Jack Bauer. He is...
He's party animal.
Not just that, though. He is very much... he's not a Republican, let me put it that way. And they torture people in that show. I mean, there's no civil liberties in that show ever. And that's probably the problem I have with that show. It's just, it really bugs me.
Well, it's a little bit close to home nowadays as well because, yeah. You know, too much of that stuff goes on in real life.
Let's jump into some of the big Mac news this week. And believe it or not, it's a huge Mac news week. Probably the number one story other than the England getting the iPhone is macOS Leopard has an update already, 10.5.1.
I don't think it's that big of a surprise that that's come out already. Just based on some of the initial problems that some people have had, it was relatively simple for Apple to go in and fix some of that. I guess the really, really big one was the move bug, or at least that's the one that people made the most press about.
I had never heard about this move bug. I guess it's been a problem.
I think since 10.3, I think it was a problem in.
I don't know anybody who moves a file. I know everybody copies files from one drive to another, but
right.
I've never invoked the move file.
No, neither have I.
No, me neither.
It seemed to get a lot of press over the last, 2 weeks or so, and here's a fix for it already. So I thought that it was probably fixed because it got into the news in the last couple weeks. But I don't know anybody who's ever had this problem. Some of the other big changes in 10.5.1, AirPort was updated. It allows password-protected accounts on AirPort disks to show up in the Finder shared sidebar, and it resolves an issue with saved passwords for wireless networks. Who wants to take the next one?
Well, I'm interested very much in the next one, the Back to My Mac. Improves the reliability of Back to My Mac-enabled Macs appearing in the Finder shared sidebar, and improves compatibility with D-Link NAT gateways. Honestly, Back to My Mac was one of the biggest reasons why I was very, very excited about Leopard.
Me too.
I have yet to get it to work.
Yeah, I haven't. Well, my problem is my older AirPort, Apple, by the way, Apple AirPort, isn't compatible with Back to My Mac.
Well, as far as I know, I've got the first generation pre-N AirPort Extreme, and I'm pretty sure that mine is compatible. Now, when I'm here at home on my home network, when I'm on my laptop, the iMac that I'm using right now at this moment shows up as a shared volume. But I've tried it a couple of times away from home, and that's the other problem is how do you test it? You have to go and find somebody else's network to leech onto to try the darn thing out, and if it's not right, then you go back, you make some settings changes, and try it again.
It hasn't worked for me, David. You've only got one machine running.
That's right. Yeah, I'm probably going to try it in the next couple of weeks. I think it's worth saying that, I mean, there's some really deep network voodoo going on actually making that work. So
yeah, no doubt.
I'm not surprised it's, that there's a few teething problems. There's so many links in the chain. I mean, if there's a problem with .Mac, I would imagine that it would fail. So maybe,
from what I'm reading and from everything I've seen, it looks like to me that .Mac, that Back to My Mac is basically making a VPN to and through .Mac.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, I kind of want to get a new AirPort just to have that functionality. But yeah, man, for $150, $200,
yeah. Well, you have to remember, there are some other benefits to the new AirPort Extremes as well. You have the USB port that you can easily just toss on a USB drive, and then there's a network attached storage with
I've got that on my AirPort. I've got the white flying saucer one, not the silver one.
Oh, did that have a USB port?
Yes.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yep. The other big update, another big update, I should say, for 10.5.1 is Disk Utilities. It restores the functionality of the progress bar during permissions repair. That was a big thing to me. I was repairing permissions, and it looked like it was doing something, but the progress bar wasn't working. So that was something that was bugging me. I haven't tested the new one, but I'm going to.
An odd one for them to miss before beta, really, but...
Addresses an issue that could produce an alert when creating disk images using disk utility or terminal, and improves disk partitioning with multiple RAIDs set to create on the same disk.
That disk image bug, I've seen that. I saw that under Tiger as well, so I'm pleased they finally got around to fixing that. Sometimes with it, in an image can just be a bit funky, and it will just come up with a really weird error message, won't let you save it out, so I'm glad they fixed that.
Yep, I've seen that myself, although redoing it usually cured the problem.
Yeah.
So I knew it was never a disk. I knew it had been something with the OS, but iCal alarms are now more reliably delivered via email. That was something that bit me.
Oh, really?
Under Tiger, iCal would always send me that email if you told it to. You know, email me this is going to happen on this certain day, and it would do it every time. It wasn't doing it at all with Leopard. I wasn't getting any email notifications. I always had it on Wednesdays when I turn in my my invoices for the freelance gigs, and I would always want to remind myself of that, and so it would always send me an email first thing in the morning saying, hey, do your invoices now, and I'd go, oh, yeah, it's Wednesday.
You've got invoices.
And it wasn't working at all under Leopard, even though I clearly went into iCal and clicked, you know, send me via email. So I'm glad that that's fixed.
Well, do you think that's related to the next issue with that it resolves an issue when inviting attendees via a, whatever the heck a CalDAV account is?
No, probably not, because that's more for, say, you're going to set up a meeting and I send everybody out an invitation.
Mm-hmm.
That's what that's for. That's totally different. Even though that really doesn't work as well as Entourage on the Mac. The Entourage client for doing CalDAV accounts is much better than Mail is. And Mail. Go ahead, David.
Mail improves stability when resizing columns in the message viewer or switching between stationary templates and email messages. Not something I've seen, but I don't really use Mail on my Leopard machine at the moment, so because I'm an Entourage user.
Yeah, I haven't used stationary yet either.
No.
I did once. I sent it out to the staff.
Yeah, I saw
it. Did you guys get that?
Yeah, we got it. Yeah.
Now, did it look like the actual stationery, or was it all attachments, or what?
No, it looked good.
It's right there on the page.
Well, awesome.
What else is in Mail? Address an issue in which attachments are closed inside an HTML link may not be clickable in email messages.
I've seen that problem. Yep.
Fix an issue with email accounts added using the simple setup feature in which messages cannot be sent due to SMT connection failure. I've seen that one actually on Tiger, where you know you have to set the outgoing mail server several times before it takes.
Right.
Improvements to smart mailboxes compatibility with .Mac. Address an issue with to-dos disappearing when using smart mailboxes.
Weren't quite so smart.
Guess not. And resolves an issue with syncing mail accounts with .Mac in which multiple On My Mac folders appear in the mailbox pane. I had some problems with synchronization on .Mac on my Leopard machine today, actually. I synchronized my Entourage calendar through .Mac to my home machine, and that had just stopped working. It stopped updating till I killed it and re-enabled it, and that was after I upgraded the machine. So it does look like there are some issues in terms of, you know, how .Mac and the syncing is integrating with the Leopard applications.
Networking addresses an issue in which Microsoft Windows shared folders may be read-only when connected via SMB, which I haven't had that issue myself. And the two places that I've used networking on Leopard on the MacBook Pro, it worked fine over Windows. And so, yeah, there's something. What's the next one, Guy?
Printing resolves an issue in which user-selected values on paper feed PDE are reset to default while saving a custom preset. I've had a few weird issues with printing under Leopard. It keeps coming up and saying, you know, is this the printer you want to use? And it's like, yeah, that's the printer I've been using for the last year and a half.
You know, I had a printing problem with Tiger from day one that did not reappear in Leopard, and that was if I simply went in there and hit Command P and printed something,
right,
it would always print horizontally on a page.
That's odd.
Instead of vertically. But if I went into page setup and changed it, it would work fine.
So it kept defaulting back to that?
But it kept defaulting to the horizontal, no matter what I did. It wasn't a huge deal because I just kind of got into the frame of mind of always going to page setup before I printed. But it was just a bug that nobody else seemed to have except for me.
Well, yeah, but plus,
and it did it every time.
Plus, that's an extra step you have to do every time you want to print something.
Oh, yeah, and it just gets annoying after.
Yeah, and the whole point of printing without opening the application is that you don't want to go through all those extra steps. You just want this document to be printed.
Yep. David, I understand the security in the firewall is updated.
Yeah, there's a they fixed a code signing issue, so third-party applications can now run when put in the application firewall settings or whitelisted in parental controls. So I guess that's useful. You can add third-party apps. This next one is interesting. In Security Preferences Firewall tab, the Block All option is now called Allow Only Essential Services. That's because they got all that flack saying, oh, when you turn Block All on, it doesn't actually still let things through the firewall. Well, if it actually blocked everything, then that wouldn't actually be very useful.
For some reason, my browser doesn't allow any websites to be seen.
Exactly.
What's going on? I'm trying to preview this song in iTunes, and it's not working.
Yeah. And there's some security updates into the security of firewall as well, some recent Apple security patches.
System and Finder addresses a potential data loss issue when moving files across partitions in the Finder. And, of course,
we were talking about that earlier.
At the beginning.
Yeah.
Yep. Resolves an issue with login after turning off File Vault for a specific user account. I've never used File Vault, so.
No.
Improves compatibility with Adobe Flash-based uploaders used by .Mac web galleries and certain other websites and applications. And resolves a potential text drawing issue with certain Adobe Flash-based websites and applications. I understand Flash under Leopard, and I really haven't investigated this much myself, is a problem.
Go ahead, Dave.
I was looking at a Flash website today on my Leopard machine, and it was really, really slow. And when I switched to my Tiger MacBook and looked at the same site, it was much, much better. So there's definitely an issue there. Which
I also understand Adobe has Acrobat 9, which resolves some of that issue.
Yeah, I'm a little bit disappointed that Adobe weren't, you know, more ready for Leopard. You know, several of their applications, like Lightroom, for instance, I'm still waiting for an update for that. It doesn't work at all well under Leopard, and it's really what's holding me back upgrading my production machine at home.
Well, and I understand some of their video and audio programs as well have some serious problems.
Well, usually time coded applications like those always have problems with a new OS. Always. So that doesn't surprise me at all.
But aren't they the lead Apple developer outside of Apple themselves? And you'd think they'd be a bit more on the ball.
Well, I can't go into specifics because I'm kind of sworn to secrecy from a person that works at Adobe. My understanding is Apple did not work with Adobe as closely as Adobe would have liked.
Right.
Let's just leave it at that.
Okay.
So the blame isn't all Adobe's.
Okay.
And I know a lot of people are coming down hard on them right now, but there's always two sides to every story, and the side that I heard kind of points the finger in the other direction just as much as at themselves.
Well, so you think Apple was to blame?
Not 100%, but let's just say that some of the fault was with Apple.
Well, we know that can't be true.
Apple is perfect. The last bit with 10.5.1 that was updated was Time Machine. Addresses formatting issues with certain drives used with Time Machine, specifically single partition drives greater than 512 gigabytes, good lord, in sizes as well as NTFS drives of any size and partition scheme. I don't know what...
NTFS is Windows XP's first...
No, I understand that. I just don't understand where...
Why it would have a problem with a drive that was had a partition larger than 512 gigs?
Yeah, and, man, I don't know. That would seem to be... You know, because right now, when I was at the Apple Store getting Leopard myself, I saw not a few people picking up some 1 terabyte drives.
Yeah.
And...
No, they're getting so cheap now, I can't believe it.
Yeah, they were paying like $3.99 for 1 terabyte. I'm like, good lord, how big is your iTunes collection, dude? Turn off LimeWire.
Yeah.
So it's good that it's finally going to work with those 1 terabyte drives. And it resolves an issue in which files restored in Time Machine may be restored to the backup hierarchy rather than the folders to which they belong. That actually happened to me on one occasion.
Yeah.
That I restored it, but it went to the backup volume and not where it was supposed to be. And I went, well, what the hell good was that?
Did it just get them backed up again straight away?
Yep. Yeah, it backed itself back up. So that's the updates to 10.5.1. We're going to see a lot more of those in the next probably year and a half.
Yep.
The other big news, Apple releases Final Cut Express 4. It's $199 or $99 upgrade.
And I'm adding it to my cart as we speak.
Are you really?
Yes, I am.
You're a big Final Cut Express user.
Well, huh? And especially I've really come to love LiveType. That's what I used last year for all of our some of the video stuff we were doing. The little logo that everybody saw just before you saw the MyMac.com MacWorld video stuff was made in LiveType.
Awesome. And it looked really good. The big changes, it adds support for the latest AVC HD cameras, allows mixing of standard and high-definition content on a single timeline, which will look like crap.
Yeah.
But
at least now you can do it.
Well, yeah, but here's the thing. If you're making a documentary in high-def, and you're pulling in some old crappy video that's obviously not in high def, that could be a problem if you couldn't mix content like that in a single timeline.
Oh, you color it in sepia and just say that it's like from the Wild Wild West or something.
There you go. Includes the ability to import iMovie 08 projects, which is oh so important because everyone loves 08 iMovie. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And gives users access to hundreds of sophisticated FX plugins, cinematic effects, and filters. It also features LiveType 2,
yay,
which is what Guy wants.
Now, if they would just sell Motion as a separate product.
And LiveType 2, I guess, has, let's see, extensive library of animated fonts, textures, templates, and effects. And you can buy Final Cut Express 4 now.
But you'll have to get in line behind me.
Guy's getting it first.
So, Tim, what's your take on this? Because I know you were very disappointed with iMovie 08 compared to iMovie 06. So, I'm not a big user of these products. So, how big a jump is it to go from iMovie 08 to Final Cut Express, which is the next level up?
I couldn't tell you. I'm not a Final Cut Express user.
No,
it's actually the learning curve on it is quite high. Final Cut Express uses, you know, almost the exact same interface as Final Cut Pro. And if you're used to doing, you know, video projects in iMovie with the single timeline and, you know, just the two audio tracks, it can be a little daunting. I still use iMovie 06 typically for currently for all the video work that I'm doing, just because it's quick, it's easy, you know, you get in, you get out, and you're all done.
Yeah.
I really need to take a little more time and learn the Final Cut interface to the point where I'm more comfortable with it. And that's really what it comes down to. What's your comfort level?
Yeah.
My problem with Final Cut, I have Final Cut Pro, I think 3. My problem with it is I got so good at using iMovie that I couldn't wrap my head around Final Cut Pro.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was so different.
Right.
The skills that you learn under iMovie do not translate at all to Final Cut.
No, they don't.
And so I was just sticking with iMovie most of the time, but I'm getting to the point now where I'm probably going to need... There's been movie projects that I had to cheat to get done where I probably wouldn't have had to do that using Final Cut.
Yeah.
I just didn't want to take the time, you know, 3 or 4 days to really get into Final Cut Pro, learn it well enough to
right.
to produce something. Yeah. So,
Final Cut
Express. Bunch of up. Go ahead.
I was just going to say Final Cut Express $199. That seems to me to be quite keenly priced.
Well, I think the older version was $299.
Yeah.
So it's come down and it's come down in price $100. And frankly, if you have an older version of Final Cut, an upgrade price of $99 is phenomenal.
Yeah.
Yep, that's a great price. It's fantastic. The other big updates this week were a security update for macOS 10.3 client, which if you're still running 10.3, it's time to upgrade.
You have our sympathies.
Security update for 10.39 server. Soundtrack Pro 202, which downloaded for me. Final Cut Pro 602. DVD Studio Pro 4.21 Motion. There's a whole bunch of them in there. But what was kind of surprising for me, at least, was that they released macOS 10.4.11. So they actually updated Tiger.
Right.
I don't think I ever remember Apple going back after the release of a major OS and updating the old version, other than Classic. They updated Classic to 9.22 after 10.1 shipped to make it more compatible. But I don't think that they went, when they released Tiger, they didn't go back to 10.3 and update that at all.
I think they did. I think when Tiger was, when Tiger was released, I think Panther was at 10.3.8. And it wasn't long after Tiger was released that a 0.9 update was released for Panther as well. I could be wrong.
If you're still running Tiger, there's an update sitting there for you.
Yep.
I wouldn't expect Apple to do much more with Tiger.
No.
It's probably going to be time to update if your machine allows Leopard compatibility.
I'm still waiting for that Jaguar update.
Yeah, dream on.
Yeah.
I guess it... They recognize, of course, that you know, they set the bar pretty high with Leopard. So there must be quite a lot of old, slower G3 and G4 machines out there that are still running Tiger. So, you know, it's good that they've had this final update for it.
Apple released iPhoto 7.1.1, which improves Leopard compatibility. I've been using Leopard and iPhoto 7.1, and I didn't find any compatibility problems.
No, I had no problems either.
It installed on my Mac, so it's even more compatible now, and that makes me very happy. Another thing that was updated that really makes me happy is Apple posted an iMac graphics firmware update 1.0 for the aluminum iMacs that has the ATI Radeon HD 2660 Pro graphics card.
Is that the one that's in your machine?
I think so. I'm not... You know what? Mine did not update.
Well, did you have any of the problems that other people were having?
Well, I haven't had this machine but for a week at this point, so no, I wasn't having any problems. Oh, what do I go under here? Graphics? ATA? No. Graphics. Where's graphics in the graphics and display? I have an ATI Radeon HD 2600.
This is a 2660 Pro.
So it sounds different.
Yeah.
But it might not be. It might just be
They might just call it the 2600 family.
Right.
Yeah.
There, where it's actually the 2660. Because I have the 24-inch iMac, the 2.8 extreme gigahertz, blah blah blah, with flame shooting out of it. iMac. This is the top of the line iMac Apple sells right
and
now.
And that's the 20-inch or the 24?
24.
Oh, okay. So you got you got the extreme one then.
Yes, I got the extreme.
Yikes.
One. And that's actually what I'm using right now. Let's see. The other big news I'm getting, there's one that I want to talk about a little bit here, but iPhone and iTouch were updated to 1.1.2, and for me at least, all my old ringtones that I made are working again. All the third party, it works.
Interesting.
Go ahead.
I was just wondering whether this happened because they had to rush the update out to match with the European launch of the iPhone, because I can't believe they would have done this, you know, without... as a purposeful thing.
Well, I believe 1.1.2 was released in Europe before it was released here. The iPhones that they're selling in England, I think already had 1.1.2 on it
And Germany.
Yeah, and Germany.
That's but right, yeah.
They hadn't released 112 for the US market yet.
No, and in fact it only appeared for my American iPhone on iTunes this evening. That was the first time that iTunes told me that there was an update that it wanted to try and apply to my iPhone. So
yeah, that was for me this morning. Yeah. And all of a sudden, the Darth Vader ring is working every time my wife calls again. So that's really
now you've cool. got that Ambrosia software, the iToner, I think it is.
Mine was Make iPhone Ringtone, and that is from Ambrosia.
Okay, yes. Yeah, I think it's called iToner.
Well, mine's called Make iPhone Ringtone version 1.0. There's probably a new one out there. It stopped working with the 111 update to the iPhone, so I didn't bother to go get a new copy of it.
Okay, yeah, I'm on the Ambrosia site right now, and they've got a box here for iToner, and it says supports iPhone OS 1.1.2.
Cool. Okay, the other big thing that I wanted to talk about this week, I am a big FileMaker Pro user, at least I used to be. I don't do as much anymore in it, because I've pretty much already created all the databases that I need. But FileMaker, which is a subdivision of Apple, released a preview of a new database program
right.
called Bento. It only works with Leopard, and it will work at least until the final version ships sometime in January 2008. I downloaded it, I launched it, but I haven't done a darn thing with it yet. I just ran out of time last
right.
night.
Yeah.
This is very, very, very interesting to me. Database is essential for any Office application. Apple has had a hole in their iLife or iWork. There was no database. Numbers kind of did it a little bit, but that's more spreadsheet. And it didn't work with like relational databases and stuff. But just by launching this, it looks very much like iWork. It's
iWorkish.
iWorkish.
Yeah, yes. It's very similar to Pages when you first start it up, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'm very interested. And from my understanding, it really works with like iCal and Mail.
Well, I can guarantee it works with Address Book because it sucked mm-hmm. everything from my Address Book right into it. No fuss, no muss.
So you did download it and give it a
yes,
shot?
Yes, I did.
I did too.
What do you think?
That's really all I've really done with it because I had to come home to do something really quick from work today, and. I'd sent away for the beta last night, and I'd finally gotten the email telling me where to go to download it. Downloaded it, tried it, you know, saw it that it sucked in Address Book, and then it was like, oh, crap, got to go back to work. So, you know, I haven't had much of a chance to play with it, but it looks really neat. Do you think that that Apple is using FileMaker to kind of test the waters for this project?
Well, I don't think there's any testing about it. I mean, this is going to be a product that's going to be released next year.
Yep.
I think that they had to bring FileMaker. The big push for FileMaker in the last couple versions has been web compatibility. And I have never used FileMaker to publish web or to publish databases online. It's always been for personal stuff. Or I've used FileMaker there was a car stereo shop in this area. And I used FileMaker to basically create an inventory tracking and a cash register for them. But something like this, this is geared more towards the home user, obviously.
Right.
But for a lot of database work, you don't need super powerful MySQL backends to tie them together. This is going to be
certainly not for the home market. You know, right. the nice thing about this is that it does all the work for you. It goes into iCal, pulls all your stuff in. It goes into Address Book, pulls all your stuff in. Basically, whatever kind of program you use that has important data in it that you want to file, it'll suck it right in.
One of my problems with it, though, and I noticed this right off the bat, was it doesn't use a document type of file format. In other words, you don't create a database, and then that's a database file that you can see on your desktop. That you can then copy and take it to work and use it with that version of FileMaker or anything. It's done within Bento.
Right.
Yeah, it's running SQL underneath, I think, so it creates a master SQL database and everything you do in it goes in there.
And I don't like that at all.
I think, you know, that issue, being able to move I mean, if you create applications in it, being able to move them from machine to machine is going to be important. But I guess, you know, it's a preview, it's in beta, and hopefully they'll add these features in. I remember when Adobe first shipped the beta of Lightroom, there was a lot of stuff that was missing that came later on. So hopefully they'll pick those up during the beta program.
I would really like this to see. I would really like this to work with, I should say, .Mac.
Yeah.
I'd love to be able to publish my databases on .Mac.
Definitely.
That would be fantastic.
Yeah.
Especially if you could have a password-protected .Mac website, say your checking account, something like that. Not necessarily a checking account, but finances without... You type in the check number and how much you paid and who you wrote it to, that sort of thing. If that was on .Mac, or at least would sync with .Mac whenever I made a change in the actual program, that would be fantastic.
Well, you could kind of do that using iWeb.
Yeah, I could.
And have a password-protected page.
But see, I use a lot of relational databases, and I don't think that this little program is going to use relational databases at all. At least not in the true sense of the word, in that I have multiple databases that are feeding a central database. By that, I don't know if how familiar you are, Guy, or David, with how a database works. I think David understands exactly what I'm saying.
I do, yeah.
For those at home listening, and I don't know how familiar you are with FileMaker, Guy, and relational databases.
Not at all.
Let's say, I'll give you the example of the this car stereo shop that I set up. One database, all it was, and it was a very simple interface, whenever they got a shipment in, they would type in what the product is, how many they got, and how much it cost. And that's all that was in that database. They had another database that was their cash register, right? That was tied into the inventory database. So they would simply type in a number, and it would populate in the field of what it is, the product, the name of the product and everything. I had another database that was running where it was just customer contact information. So they would just type in the first name, and boom, their address was filled out and everything. And these were all separate databases, and it worked really well, and it made the main database that they had to use extremely lightweight and very, very fast. But the big point of it is that you could take data from one database and reuse it in another database without having to repopulate it with all new information.
That's a big time saver.
It's a huge time saver, and relational databases have been around forever. And that's when I think of databases, my mind immediately goes to relational databases, and that's where I think I'm going to have some problem. I'm going to try this, obviously, and I might end up buying. I think it's going to be $99 when it releases.
Yeah. I just hope you'll be able to grow from it to the full version of FileMaker relatively easily, because obviously what will happen, you've seen this for many years on the Windows side, people used to use Microsoft Access, and they would build whole complicated applications in Access, and really when you wanted to scale those applications, you need to move them up to a real proper database system like SQL Server, and you couldn't do that very easily. So I hope that FileMaker doesn't make the same mistake with Bento, and you know they provide a migration path so that when you outgrow it, you know, when your simple application actually needs to become something more complicated, that you can just ship it straight up to FileMaker. Yeah.
Right,
exactly. And then that's kind of what I was talking about with iMovie earlier. What I learned in iMovie did not translate at all into FileMaker Pro or into Final Cut Pro, Final Cut Express or Final Cut Pro, yeah. But I want to take these skills that I learned in one application and apply them in another. Do you think that FileMaker proper is going to see more of an iWork type of interface anytime soon?
I hope so. It's a bit unfriendly at the moment. I have loaded up the demo and had a look at it because, you know, I when I first moved to the Mac, I thought with my background in SQL Server that it would be a good thing for me to get my head around. But I've got to admit, I struggled with it. It was really quite kind of hard because it comes up and it is so blank. There is so little there, and it's a case of, you know, well, where do I start if I want to create a new database? So, you know, if it can ease you in by using more of a template-based approach, then that would be better.
Right.
Well, FileMaker does have a template system that you can access, but it didn't come up right at the beginning. When you launch FileMaker for the first time, it's, you know, you're presented with a blank page.
Yeah.
And it had a multiple work areas. You know, this is the one that you work in when you're creating fields. This is the work area when you're actually populating fields. So it was very confusing for a lot of new users. And I was one of them initially, but obviously as a Power FileMaker user now, I completely understand it. So for me, it's going to be very hard to go to Bento. Maybe. I haven't tried it yet, so maybe it won't be that difficult, but I'm so used to the way
sounds like a product
I do
review
things now. Yeah, probably. Probably. You got some notes up here too, Guy. What do you got?
Oh, where to start? Well, we talked about the OS X update. One thing that I found kind of interesting was that the Warner Music CEO thinks that Apple has done a good job and actually said so publicly.
He was the guy that was blasting Steve Jobs publicly just 2 years ago, wasn't
he?
Yeah,
but now the current bad guy is Jeff Zucker over at NBC.
Yeah, from NBC.
Yeah, he was speaking to a group of GMSA, or he's speaking to a group at the GMSA Mobile Asia conference, and praised the Apple iTunes Store as the one to emulate, telling them that ignoring the success of Apple is done so at your own risk. Earlier this month, of course, NBC Universal exec Jeff Zucker claimed that Apple had essentially destroyed the music business, and former Disney CEO Michael Eisner has weighed in on the writer's strike and is encouraging Hollywood scribes to picket Cupertino instead of the studios.
Yeah, I read that.
there's a reason why he doesn't run Disney anymore, because he's friggin' crazy.
And there's a reason that he's going to say bad things about Apple, and that's because of Steve Jobs.
Right.
He does not like, I don't care what anybody, he doesn't like Steve Jobs because Steve Jobs basically outed him. Pixar did to Disney what Next did to Apple. Let's be honest. All the big people at Pixar became the big people at Disney, replacing all these Disney executives who literally was running that company into the ground with just crap after crap after crap.
That's right. Call it like it is. He came, he saw, he kicked their ass.
He did, absolutely.
Yeah.
No question.
Leopard...
I'm happy about it.
Leopard has been hacked to run on non-Apple PCs, otherwise known as Hackintoshes. Yeah.
I don't even care about that. Who cares?
One thing I saw today that was actually quite interesting. Have you seen this Asus EEE PC, this really tiny laptop?
Yeah, it's got like a 6-inch screen.
Yeah, that's right. But they have Leopard running on that now. And I looked at that, and I saw the pictures on their gadget, and I thought, I really hope Apple are looking at this and saying, we could do a product like that in January.
Well, that thing only does like 600 by 800 pixels.
It's not a MacBook or a PowerBook by any stretch of the imagination. But the fact that this machine is capable of running Leopard says to me that Apple could do the job properly and give us a very nice sub notebook.
It's all solid.
Yeah, we don't usually talk about rumors, but that's one of the rumors that I've heard is that there's going to be a ultra portable coming up at Macworld.
Well, I don't know whether they'll actually do that or not, but
You still there, David?
I don't know whether the rumor is true or not, but even if they're not, I hope that the guys at Apple look at it and say, you know, maybe start thinking about it, because it's the sort of product I'd really like to see in the future, whenever it happens.
Well, we'll find out in January if it's anytime soon.
We need to get Owen over there.
Yeah, let's send Apple over there, or Owen over there, and... because he really wants a sub. Now, we've got a couple other things coming up on the show, including a fenestration with our own David Cohen. What's coming up on fenestration this week?
This week, I'm talking a little bit about Leopard from the point of view of using it in a Windows environment. And then the main topic is talking about my experiences using Entourage and getting that talking to Microsoft Exchange Server on the Windows side.
We also have Robert Hazelrig sent in a file. I haven't listened to it yet about his Leopard install, so I don't know if that's going to be a positive or a negative review, but we'll listen to that. And we've got a real interesting interview that John Nemo did. Believe it or not, it's not a computer book
guy.
Oh, my God. And his name is Morton Warren. I think it's a really, really interesting interview, one of the best John's ever done. And we're going to finish out the show with that. But right now, it's going to be kind of strange because we're talking to David Cohen live. Now we're going to listen to pre-recorded David Cohen and Fenestration. But first, thanks, David and Guy, for coming on the show this week. David, this is an open invitation. I know it's late there in England, But we record, you know, the time. Anytime you want to be on the show, certainly. Just, you know, be on Skype at the right time, and you're on. Right. I love your opinions. You're not Chad, but
actually,
you did an apt job of playing.
Actually, yeah, Chad and I though we do share the same build and hairline. So
let's not talk about hairlines. That's a very sore subject for me.
No, it's I have no problem.
Yeah,
with that.
I know.
mine's my expanding waistline. That's starting to become a problem. So anyways, my expanding waistline is out of here, and Guy will be back next week. And I don't know what's going on with Chad. I know he's still doing the out-of-town work on Thursdays when we record. So hopefully Chad will be back on the show pretty soon.
Actually, next Thursday is Thanksgiving. Did you want to do that one early?
Boy, oh boy, oh boy. We may skip it. I don't know if we'll have a show next week
or maybe just
not.
Do it either on like Tuesday or Friday.
Possibly. If we have a show next week, we did it. If show 155 comes out in 2 weeks, we didn't do a show. And as some of you know, I am expecting, well, my wife is expecting, and she's due within 2 weeks. So maybe we should do a show next week because it may be the last for at least a week after that. Who knows? The baby comes when the baby comes, and I have no control of it. And quite honestly, if there's a choice of being, you know, in the delivering room
doing
or
a podcast.
Hearing the podcast,
I was gonna say just put the baby's delivery in your iCal.
If my wife will allow me to break away from the delivery room, maybe. You know. Not that I don't thoroughly enjoy being in that room when the baby's born. Absolutely, it's the greatest thing for guys. We absolutely
just,
love
just
it.
As her water breaks is when Apple went out some amazing product.
Sorry, honey, I have to go to San Francisco.
You did this to me!
So, I don't know if we're going to do a show next week or not. And if we
You'll
do, cool. We'll communicate via email before. And anyways, here comes David Cullen's Fenestration.
Hello. My name is David Cohen, and I'm the London Bureau Chief for MyMac.com. Welcome to Fenestration, my guide to using a Mac in a Windows world. Welcome to Fenestration number 40 from the MyMac podcast number 154. In today's session, I'm going to talk a little bit about using Leopard in a Windows environment, but my main topics are going to be about using Entourage to talk to Microsoft's Exchange server. So firstly, to Leopard. I have this installed on my machine at work now, which as previous lessons will know is a PowerMac G4 with dual 450MHz processors in it and about 1.5GB of RAM. I had to do a little bit of hacking to get Leopard to install on such a machine because it does check for the minimum processor of 800MHz, and if it finds that, it won't actually install. What I was able to do was actually install Leopard onto a hard drive and then boot it from there, and that allowed me to change one of the preference files that actually checks for the machine it's being installed on and allow the installation to go ahead. I was pleasantly surprised to find that it actually works really, really well. One of the reasons for this is that I upgraded the video card in that machine from the original ATI Rage card that came with the machine as stock to a more advanced ATI Radeon, I think it's a 5350 or something like that. It's one of the older Radeon cards, but it's certainly a bit more powerful than the original Rage card that was in there. And having done that, that allows Leopard to work okay. Everything is working pretty much as it should, it all looks as it should, and it actually is very, very, very responsive. One of the reasons for that is that Apple has done some work on the networking stack, and it's now multi-threaded, which means that when it tries to make a connection and it's waiting for information to come back over the network from a server, it doesn't beach ball on you, but it actually hands control back straight away while it makes the connection in the background. This massively improves the networking experience you find with Leopard talking to Windows servers. The other thing that I find really useful when browsing through Windows files, which, let's face it, aren't often named and organized as well as they would be if they'd been saved by Mac users, is that you can use the new Cover Flow and Quick Look features to browse through the files very easily. It's now actually quite simple to browse through large, complicated folder structures on a Windows server. I did have a couple of compatibility issues, but those were addressed pretty quickly by upgrading various drivers and software packages to make sure they were Leopard compatible. I haven't installed Leopard yet on my Intel MacBook, because I know that I do have a couple of applications in there that haven't actually yet been updated for Leopard. But one that definitely has is VMware Fusion, the virtualization software for the Macintosh that competes directly with Parallels. They released version 1.1 just a couple of days ago, and I have installed that on my MacBook. Generally, the system seems to be operating a bit faster than it was before, and certainly they've improved the graphics handling. The Unity feature that allows your Windows applications to work directly in the OS X environment now works a lot more seamlessly than it did before. Fusion 1.1 is a free upgrade to registered users. So, on to the main topic, which is the use of Entourage to talk to Microsoft Exchange Server. Now, for those not in the know, Exchange Server is pretty much the leading mail platform, and you'll find it in many offices all over the world. It's not just a mail server, it's really more of a groupware and collaboration product. It's evolved steadily over the years, and it's now quite mature and relatively fully featured. Windows users talk to Exchange using a client called Microsoft Outlook that forms part of the Windows version of Office. Outlook uses a protocol called MAPI, or Messaging Application Programming Interface, to talk directly to the Exchange server. And it is this that allows Outlook to tie very, very closely to the functions with Exchange. As you might expect, bearing in mind that Microsoft developed both of them. Now, when you load up the Macintosh version of Office, you'll find a program called Entourage. You might initially think that Entourage is effectively the Macintosh version of Outlook, which it is and it isn't. It is in that it talks to an Exchange server and effectively is a similar sort of PIM-type application as Outlook, but unfortunately, Entourage does not talk to the Exchange server using MAPI. Instead, it uses WebDAV, which is the same protocol that you will find on your machine if you ever use iDisk on .Mac. The problem with WebDAV, as its name suggests, is that it was aimed at being an internet protocol. Consequently, it can't hook directly into the Exchange server in the same way that a MAPI application can. And this is one of the things that causes Entourage to be a little bit of a problem on the Mac. Firstly, when you fire the application up, you need to configure it to talk to your Exchange server. Now, on the Windows side, that's very straightforward. You just give it the name of your Exchange server and the name of your mail account, and it goes and configures everything for you. Entourage on the Mac doesn't do that. First of all, your Exchange server needs to be running some web protocol so that the WebDAV will be accepted by it. Effectively, this means the Exchange server needs to be running web protocols, and that means that your Exchange administrator has to have enabled those protocols. Now, this isn't always necessarily the case. Depending on the configuration of the Exchange server and exactly how it's talking to users who aren't within the company, you may not have web protocols enabled, in which case Entourage is not going to be able to help you. Unfortunately, if you're in that situation, you may find your request to get these web protocols enabled on the Exchange server will fall on deaf ears from your system administrator. Even once you get past that, once you actually try and configure Entourage to talk to the Exchange server, it's not as straightforward as it is on the Windows side. You can't just feed it in a name and an account name and let it go on ahead and do everything. You need to configure quite a few relatively complicated network settings, and you also need to understand quite a few advanced computing terms, terms such as LDAP, which is a directory service that allows you to get your address book from the Exchange server, for instance. Consequently, this means that configuring Entourage to talk to Exchange server is actually quite a techie process. And if you're a user who isn't very technical, then you may struggle to get it working properly. Once you've got it up and running, it looks broadly the same as Outlook. There are a couple of things that are different. But the problem with Entourage is really the fact that it presents things that look the same as the Windows version of the software, but in fact don't work as well. It all comes down to that WebDAV protocol rather than the use of MAPI. Let me demonstrate. You'll find that you can access your Exchange calendar in much the same way you can as if you were using Outlook on a Windows machine. But when you actually try and use it, you'll find that it doesn't actually work quite as you expect. Certainly, if you access the same calendar from a Windows machine and a Mac, you can end up with an odd situation where your appointments get duplicated, and also you can find that the duplicate appointments actually have their time shifted by an hour, so an all-day appointment that would ordinarily last from midnight to midnight now runs from 1 a.m. to 1 a.m. and that consequently appears to be of 2 days. There is a set of to-do functions, which initially look like they operate just the same as they would do in Outlook. But in fact, you'll find the to-dos aren't synchronized to the Exchange server. And if you then come to the Exchange server from an Outlook machine to your same account, you won't find them there. Functions such as public folders don't work properly, and also free busy information, which is what you use to arrange a meeting by checking multiple calendars. None of that's available from Entourage either. If you search the web, you'll find there's a whole load of these sorts of wrinkles within Entourage, which means that it just doesn't work as well as the Windows version of the software for talking to Exchange Server. I've ended up in a situation now where I do use Entourage on my Mac, for reasons which I'll explain in a minute, but I also have to use a Windows version of the software running under Citrix or running on my Intel Mac to do all the complicated stuff like the calendaring, the free busy information, the to-do lists, the public folders. Basically, if I need to do anything over and above basic calendaring or email, then I can't really rely on Entourage to do the job for me. So you might ask, well, you're in the lucky position that you've got an Intel Mac. Why do you even bother using Entourage at all? Well, there are a couple of advantages that Entourage gives you, and consequently, if you do own the Macintosh version of Office and you've got Entourage anyway, it's worth considering using it for these features. The main one for me, and the reason that I run Entourage most of the time, is that I get mail notifications within the Macintosh environment if I'm running it. As new mail comes in, Entourage will pop up a little window in the bottom right-hand corner of my screen with the name and the title of the email, and it will also generate a quiet alarm, so I know when I've received new mail. This notification of incoming email is something that I don't get if I'm running the thin client with Outlook in that session, so it's something I do find useful. The other thing that Entourage gives you is synchronization with iCal and your Macintosh address book. This is a relatively new feature that was only enabled with a service pack earlier on this year, but it really is quite a good one. Entourage will create a calendar within your iCal called Entourage, and that will list all your Exchange events. It will also synchronize your address book with the contacts database in Exchange. Now, I use this because I want to get that information onto my iPhone. And the only way really to do it is to synchronize it from Entourage to my address book and iCal, and then synchronize those up via my .Mac account to my home machine. This means that when I dock my iPhone at home at the end of the day, I receive all the latest calendar and contacts address book updates. And similarly, if I make any changes to those calendaring or address book information on my iPhone, that gets synchronized back to the Exchange server. The final bonus you get from using Entourage is the fact you actually have end up with an offline copy of all your mail on your Macintosh. This means that you can access that mail if you're out of the office if it's a laptop, or alternatively you can access it in the office if the Exchange server is down for any reason. And let's face it, it's a Windows machine, so that does happen from time to time. Mail items within Entourage are searchable via Spotlight, so it does mean that you can access the information within your mail store quite readily. And in this respect, you're getting better search facilities than you would on a Windows machine, as the search facilities with Outlook are fairly weak. So, in summary, Entourage 2004, a little bit of a mixed bag. It would be nice if we were having strong messages from Microsoft that MAPI support was coming in the next version of Entourage, but they've said nothing of the sort. The only information they've talked about in Entourage coming for the next version has talked about some extra improvements to the free busy information and a new application that sits on your desktop and gives you a one-shot view of what you've got on a particular day. But it doesn't sound like they're doing any fundamental rewrites to Entourage underneath the hood. That's going to do it for this session. As always, please send questions or comments to davidcohen@mymac.com. Until the next time.
Hello, Robert Hisrick here. Today I'd like to talk to you about my Leopard installation on my PowerMac G5. But before I get started, I want to also let you know that since installing Leopard on my iBook, which is a 1.2 GHz machine with less than a gig of RAM, aside from a very lengthy install process, that iBook has been working flawlessly. I wish I could say the same for my G5. Unlike my iBook, my G5 is a mission-critical machine, which means I'm running a lot of pro apps on it, including the Creative Suite, specifically Creative Suite 3. And I have run into one reoccurring problem which I find very frustrating, and that is whenever I'm doing a save as from within InDesign, InDesign crashes. I've also seen this happen in Photoshop when I'm doing a save as and when I navigate to my desktop. I haven't experienced this issue with Illustrator, but I haven't been using Illustrator all that much recently. Just to give you a little bit more about the background of the machine, it's a dual processor, 2 gigahertz machine with 1.5 gigs of RAM, so it's fairly moderate as far as computing systems go. Moreover, the type of install I did was a clean install on a new hard drive, a small hard drive, and then I used Migration Assistant to move over the applications that I wanted. Because the drive is much smaller than the original drive that I had on my system, I used 2 shareware applications that I believe you might find useful as well. The first one is AppZapper, and I used AppZapper to go in and clean out all the applications that I knew that would not work with Leopard, as well as some other older applications which I no longer use. The other application I used was called WhatSize. WhatSize is a simple application that shows you in a hierarchical form all of the folders that you have on a hard drive, and it lists them in the order of the folder which is the largest to the smallest. This is really handy if you need to clean out any large folders. For instance, I have not been using Apple Soundtrack for quite some time and had nearly 1 gig of loops on my system that I removed. WhatSize helped me find where those files were hidden. AppZapper costs $12.95 and WhatSize is free. We'll have links to those in the show notes. One last thing I'd like to mention before I go is that I am not going to stick with Leopard on this mission critical machine. I can't afford to have InDesign crashing on me frequently, nor can I afford to have any application crashing on me frequently. The other reason I'm not going to be sticking with Leopard on this machine is that I have 2 Fiery printers, a Minolta 3102 and a Minolta C300. And right now, Leopard is not playing well with either of these 2 Fiery drivers. So between the frequent crashing and the inability to print, I'm very, very happy that I installed this on a separate hard drive and then I can easily switch back to the Tiger install. Well, that's it for me this week. This has been Robert Hazelrig. Thanks for listening.
Recently, a renowned British audio company called Bowers & Wilkins produced a magnificent Zeppelin. That's Zeppelin. It's a monster speaker for the iPod. And we are delighted to have the designer, the industrial designer, Morton Warren from London, England, from Native Design, with us live on the MyMac.com podcast. Nice to meet you, Morton.
Nice to meet you, too.
How long have you been working with Bowers & Wilkins?
For the past sort of 12 to 15 years. I actually designed a product when I was at college, and they were interested in that when I graduated, and kind of somehow been related with them ever since.
But you do a bunch of other industrial design. Can you tell our listeners briefly what industrial design is and why we need to care or know about it for things like iPods or monster iPod speaker units?
Yeah, well, actually, we work with probably most of the world's top manufacturers of products, whether that's Hewlett-Packard in California, Motorola in Chicago, Audi in Ingolstadt in Germany, all variety of companies, also sort of companies like Toshiba in Japan. We've mainly concentrated on consumer electronics. I personally find that always an intriguing subject. And industrial design involves the pursuit of, I suppose, creating better products for us humans to use. Also part of what we do is interaction design, so we actually help not only make the products look nice, feel good, and easy to manufacture, but also are engaging to use, and that's also part of what Native Design does.
And obviously, when you're working with Apple, you have to work with their marketing people as well as their audio spec people as well as the Bowers & Wilkins people. Who has to keep all this stuff organized and coordinated so you know whether you're coming or going?
Yes, it's pretty tricky. I think it's partly Native's job and partly Bowers and Wilkins. It was very rewarding to be at Apple last year when we revealed the design to them, and seeing their reaction was really great. It was I think we've hit upon a product that's made to the same sort of quality and the design intent as the sort of products that you've become used to from Apple itself, and it's been great to see such a reception that the Zeppelin has had.
Now, in our show notes for this podcast, I'm going to put a link to the Zeppelin by Bowers and Wilkins, and also a link to the Native Design website of your business. But I'm going to briefly describe the Zeppelin as a user. If you can imagine American football that's been stretched till it's over 2 feet long, and it's got a beautiful black fabric grill, but sticking out from the front of it is this big arm that looks sort of like a gear shift, and you stick your iPod on that, and that serves as the docking cradle. Now, that's what it looks like at first glance. How would you describe it from an industrial design? Oh, and there's two portholes on the back, two big holes where the sound comes out the back. Now, how would you describe it from an industrial design perspective?
Well, okay, I think the first thing to think about is that the iPod, when it was first created, was intended for you to use in your hand, and thus you would use your thumb to scroll the wheel up and down when you interact with the menus on the screen. Now, all the other music docking devices meant that you had to dock the pod vertically into a mount, which meant that you couldn't actually use your thumb anymore, that you had to use your finger and sort of stroke the wheel. And actually, that's not the way that the iPod was intended to be used. So this arm that you're talking about was actually created so you can wrap your hand around the iPod while it's engaged in the dock, and thus you've got exactly the same interaction experience using the Zeppelin as you would do using the iPod when it's in your hand. And that was the real, I think, striking feature about Zeppelin before we even talk about the aesthetic, is that actually it makes your iPod much easier to use, and ironically is also making the iPhone just as easy to use when you use the iPhone with it.
Sure. Now, I have found that for my personal use, I've got one of these things sitting in my office, and believe me, it sounds great. It costs $600 in the United States, and this is the biggest, baddest iPod speaker system you're ever going to see, and as far as I know, it's only going to be sold at the Apple Store, but we can talk about that another time. But I mostly don't touch it. I set my iPod on this docking cradle arm thing, and I mostly use the little puck remote. Is that how you use yours most of the time?
Yeah, and you can use the remote. It's just sometimes you might walk past and you want to engage or find and access certain tracks on your iPod, and then it gives you the ability to do that with your thumb, as I was mentioning. But the pressed metal back, it's a pure stainless steel component that's bonded on the back. A lot of people talk about the environment and designing products that are sort of, let's say, more environmentally friendly. We certainly can't claim that the Zeppelin is any more environmentally friendly than other iPod docks. But what I would say is that with a product that we've created, which is really so sort of quality focused, that it becomes a real ornament, I think, in your house, in your home, and you really would think twice about throwing something like that away in a few years' time. I think it has a certain design acumen about it that you would want to keep forever, and I think that's always good design if you can create something that people want to keep as opposed to just dispose of, once it's gone out of fashion.
Okay, I've got two unrelated questions. Okay. You can answer them in either order. Number one, why, when I'm picking up the little puck remote, I can't tell which is the top, so I always have to look at it. Could I suggest in your version 2, this may go against your design aesthetic, but can I suggest in version 2 that you put some little dot or some little something so the user can tell immediately which is the top and which
yeah,
is the,
it's interesting
which is the
you
best.
Should mention that. We were criticized, actually, about that very early on. But we always feel that it wasn't that difficult. You know, once you've picked it up, that you'd learn which buttons should be sort of directed in the right way. But there has been a lot of feedback about that. I think perhaps we're a little bit over stubborn on that. So you're absolutely right. I think we will look at putting a little dot feature or something so you can feel which is the right way around.
And whether it's a puck or whether it's an arm or whether it's a speaker design, how many prototypes and samples do you make and how do you evaluate them?
Oh, well, I mean, there's a very good example of a very interesting remote that we did for Hewlett-Packard in California, which was a remote that you definitely knew which way around it went. We made about 30 or 40 different prototypes. And tested them, validated them around the world, and actually came up with a very unique, iconic design that ended up influencing the entire line of products that HP make, whether it's printers, cameras, TVs, etc. So that was an interesting program that we did that had a big, huge influence on a multi-billion-dollar company.
Well, going back to the Zeppelin, the amazing iPod speaker, which is sold and created by Bowers and Wilkins with the help of Morton Warren and his native design firm in London. How much of Zeppelin's unusual shape is for sonic response, and how much is it strictly for style and design?
Well, as you might know, we've been involved with the design of loudspeakers for many, many years. So I think what's unusual about Zeppelin, again, compared to other speakers, is that it really has been designed with a knowledge of sound. And therefore, the shape actually does follow function. The bulge in the middle is wider in the middle. That allows for the subwoofer bass unit to sit underneath the arm. Then the two other drive units sit as the shape tapers, with the tweeter sitting either end. And it's very good for a tweeter to sit within a very small amount of space. If you look at the 800 series of Bowers and Wilkins, you'll see that the tweeter actually sits on top of the loudspeaker. That's because
it performs
much better like that. So actually, that shape is excellent acoustically, and so it's a beautiful form, but also has very good sonic rationale.
Well, what's the ideal room position relative to the walls and the corners with those two exhaust holes in the back?
Okay, well, those ports, again, if you want more bass, you would probably want to sit the system towards the wall, maybe even into a corner, and that would then excite your room even more and you would create much more bass. If you wanted less bass, you could take the speaker slightly further away from the wall, and that would reduce the amount of bass that you would receive.
Well, we are planning on having a comparable conversation with one of your comrades over at Bowers and Wilkins, but from a design point of view, was your goal full-spectrum audio clarity with enhanced bass? Because I need to reduce the bass on my iPod for optimal listening. I guess I'm just too old for that thumping bass that a lot of people want. The clarity, I'm not kidding, the clarity is unbelievable, but the bass will rattle your windows.
Yes, we've been quite amazed. We have one in a studio here, which is about 7,000, 8,000 square feet, and it's just, I walked in one day and I thought that there was a much bigger system playing, and I was, to my surprise, amazed by the amount of bass that's coming out of the Zeppelin. I think that in today's market, certainly the kind of slightly younger generation have a desire for sort of low frequencies, especially with movies and subwoofers and things. They've become accustomed to feeling bass as opposed to hearing it. And I think the Zeppelin manages to do that. But again, you can go into your adjustments within your settings on the iPod and reduce the bass and really fine-tune the system to however you like.
What happens if somebody picks up the Zeppelin by that handle where the dock is mounted? Is it going to come flying off the chassis?
No, actually, that handle's made of pressed stainless steel, so it's incredibly strong. You'd have to be you'd have to go out of your way to really break it if you wanted to. But I think you'll also notice that there's actually two rubber plinths for the Zeppelin to sit on. and that was designed for people who want to critically listen to music, and it orientates the speakers into a dead horizontal mode for critical listening. Alternatively, if you just want room-filling sound, you sit it on its normal intended base.
Yes, I've been using it on the standard rubber foot for now, and then later on I'll play around with it and I'll put it on the other one. I'm not sure in my house it's going to make a lot of difference.
Oh, it will. It's actually quite amazing what the difference it makes. And considering how much that little part costs, the acoustic engineers really fought to have that included in the packaging. So I think I would encourage you definitely sit down, get the Zeppelin salad about, you know, ear height, and then put it on the plinth, and you'll see a huge difference.
I had some people over for a Photoshop lesson the other day, and it had just arrived, and so I had my iPod on. I didn't say a word. I was just playing some music, and first everybody walks in and says, "What is that weird thing?" And I said, "Oh, that's just a little iPod speaker I'm using." And then they said, "How much does it cost?" And I said, $600. And half the people fell over dead on the spot. And the other half said, "Where do I get one?" So obviously, there's a dividing point on the price. But if people want fine quality audio, the Zeppelin by Bowers & Wilkins, or B&W as it's known, should definitely be considered. It's about a million times better than any other speaker that's in the Apple store. And I don't care how many people I'm insulting, but that's indeed the case.
Yeah, I do believe it's something that you'll keep for a long, long time. And I think you need to think about, if you're spending $300 or $400, is it worth spending another $200 knowing you're going to buy a product that you're going to treasure for many, many years?
Absolutely. Well, the most important question is, do all of your employees and colleagues at Native Design get a free Zeppelin that they can have with them in their office and their house?
They certainly will, but they're not available in Europe yet, so we're still waiting.
Well, it's been a pleasure meeting you. This is going to be on the MyMac.com podcast. We've been speaking with Morten Warren from Native Design of London, England, discussing the Bowers & Wilkins Zeppelin $600 iPod speaker that is now available, we hope. Is it available now in the United States?
It's available in the United States, but not in Europe yet. I believe it's going to be coming out January 08.
Good. Well, it's been a pleasure to meet you, and we hope they sell a million of them, and we're going to keep our eyes on Morten Warren on Native Design, and we're going to keep our ears on the Bowers & Wilkins Zeppelin.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Okay.
Thanks for downloading the MyMac.com podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast at our RSS feed at MyMac.com or by visiting the iTunes Music Store's podcast section. Please send all feedback to MyMacPodcast@gmail.com. And thanks for listening to the MyMac.com podcast.